sitting on that stool. He's a cowhide kicking fool. Swing it, Mary.
Hi, I'm Stuart Copeland, and that was the guy I'm here to talk about, Gene Krupa, drumming man. Drum god of the old order, an inspiration to me and thousands of drummers across the world. Hard to believe Gene was born 100 years ago, January 15th, 1909. There's nothing antique about this guy, and you always knew he was there, whether you were listening in 1927... or in the great days of swing, 10 years later, in 1937. Or getting close to modernism in 1947.
To get to see the film, The Gene Krupa Story, which was at the Odeon in Handsworth, in Birmingham, where I'm from. And my father took me along to see it, and I was just completely amazed by what I saw. It was just an incredible experience. I just started playing, wasn't very good, and then suddenly I get to see this guy playing, and I'm thinking, wow. You know, and it was a big, major impression. This was a major shift for me. And I remember the opening titles where you saw him playing this sort of beautiful sort of white marine pearl drum set. And the way they had lit the stage, there was these huge shadows on the wall of him playing. And I thought, oh, this is just tremendous. And that was it. And as I've said before many times, I walked out that cinema and I said to my dad, you know, that's what I want to be. That's what I'm going to do. And I've walked down that path ever since.
That was Carl Palmer of Emerson, Lake & Palmer. So you can see, Gene Krupa's influence has gone well beyond jazz. But that's where Gene himself always stayed, which you'd expect from a guy who came up in Chicago in the mid-1920s. Jazz had just moved there from New Orleans, bringing King Oliver, young Louis Armstrong, a host of hornmen, and the most adventurous black drummers of the day, Baby Dodds and Zooty Singleton. And there were white players, too, Davy Tuff and George Wetling, and others.
I mean, the idiom was really cultivated and created by people like Baby Dodds and Zooty Singleton. But, you know, there were people like Billy Gladstone, who was a famous percussionist, and Vic Burton, who was a great virtuoso in the 1920s, you know, who influenced other folks as well. So I think from the very beginning of jazz drums, there was always a dialogue.
Lauren Schoenberg, executive director of the Jazz Museum in Harlem. There was no guarantee at first that Gene Krupa was going to join that dialogue. He came from Chicago's enormous Polish community. Even today, it members not far short of 200,000 Polish speakers, and they were, for the most part, devout Catholics. The young Eugene Bertram Krupa nearly took that route professionally.
Yes, I mean, when you watch the Gene Krupa story, you know, that's one of the opening things, is that his mother didn't want him to go off and mix in this world of show business. She wanted him to be a priest, and you're right, he studied that, yeah.
Luckily, the idea of Father Krupa was replaced by a different form of shamanism, and those Chicago drummers came to the fore again. They too were preachers in their way. Listen to the gospel of Baby Dodds.
And drumming, you have got to pay attention to each and every one. You must hear that person distinctly and hear what he wants. You got to give it to him. If he don't like that, if he don't get going, give him something else. And that way you keep your band smooth. It's keep your band jumping. And keep everybody lively. Oh, you must be a musician. You can't just be anybody. Anybody can't drum. Anybody can beat a drum, but anybody can't drum. You must study those things. Study a guy's human nature and study it's about what he will take. I'll see about what he will go for. All that's in a drummer. And that's why all guys is not drummers that's drumming.
Thus spoke Gene's first big influence, a lasting one according to the great veteran drummer of modern jazz, Ed Shaughnessy.
Oh, I think you can hear that in his playing. He has a sort of a snare drum style that definitely has a Baby Dodds influence. Baby had a way of sort of dancing the beat, and he was famous for that. And Gene, I think, got a lot of influence from Baby. That type of feeling, you know, sort of a toe-tapping feeling, actually. And Baby also was quite melodic.
He always credited Baby with being the man, and also Zooty Singleton to an extent. But he always said that Baby and hanging out with the clubs in the south side of Chicago, he was one of that group loosely known as the Austin High Gang. Some of them were from Austin High, who would pedal their bicycles down to the night spots and just pour over the music.
Jazz historian Jeffrey Smith. Baby Dodds had already played a role in some of the greatest early jazz records made in Chicago in 1923 by King Oliver's Creole Jazz Band. But they're acoustic recordings, which have two drawbacks from the point of view of drums. First, the drums are not easy to pick out in the general wash of sound since they're the loudest instruments in the band. They're always at the back, furthest from the microphone, because the microphone loves the sound of those cymbals. So they always move the drums to the back. It makes the drums kind of echoey and indistinct. You could hear the woodblocks here, but sometimes it's all a drummer was allowed to play, give or take the odd cymbal crash, because the engineers said they couldn't cope with a full drum set. Drums get all over everything.
Well, those tom-toms and bass drums are going to knock the needle right off my wax. And so they didn't want to have that. And in the great recordings with the King Oliver Creole Jazz Band, Baby Dodds is just sort of playing woodblocks and cymbals and a little bit of snare. There certainly isn't anything bigger than that going on.
This has led to a historical controversy that still rumbles on. It doesn't really matter, but the question is still asked anyway. Who then was the first drummer to record with a full set of drums? One position is very forthrightly taken by the drummer Richard Pite, who was recently seen at London's Cadogan Hall, impersonating Krupa in a recreation of Benny Goodman's Carnegie Hall concert of 70 years ago.
This business about Krupa being the first person to play a full drum kit in a recording studio, I think that's absolute rubbish. This theory's been going around for years, and whenever you read anything about Krupa, it always mentions the year 1927 when he was playing with Eddie Condon. He was the first drummer to use a kit. And I think, well, wait a minute. Has anybody actually listened to those original Dixieland Jazz Band recordings? In 1917, 1918, you can clearly hear a full kit on there. You can hear a bass drum on there. So what is this all this rubbish about 10 years later? You can. All you got to do when I was doing this research into it is listen to those recordings. You can hear a bass drum on that.
And of course he's right. As early as 1917 on Liberty Stable Blues by the original Dixieland Jazz Band, the bass drum of Tony Spargo can be heard delivering some sturdy thumps. Now, when electrical recording arrived in the mid-20s, everything should have changed, and mostly it did, except for the same old problem.
The engineers didn't want the bass drum because it made the recording needle jump off the grooves.
Professor Dan Morgenstern of the Institute of Jazz Studies at Rutgers University.
However, with Gene when he recorded with Condon McKenzie Chicagoans in December of 1927. He was able to use the bass drum. He convinced the engineer that if he put some baffles around the drum, it would be possible to record. And indeed, they did.
Well, if they did, the evidence is inconclusive, because most of the percussion audible in the session came from Jim Lannington's slapped bass and the banjo of Eddie Condon. Even at the climaxes of the numbers, Gene Kitt's sounds rationed rather than full. Those muscular backbeats towards the end there would soon become a Krupa trademark. He was a progressive guy, socially as well as musically. In Chicago at that time, there was a young, pretty, and strong-minded string bass player called Thelma Terry, talented enough to attract the attention of MCA, the Music Corporation of America, who organized an all-male band to showcase the lady. That was how Gene Krupa became the drummer of the first notable jazz-era band led by a woman instrumentalist, Thelma Terry and her Playboys. She was a nice bass player, but to let her be heard, Gene had to stay under wraps once more. Oh, man. It wasn't really until the Chicagoan traveled to New York that he got the full measure of the business they were in. But they were naturally assertive guys, and they brought a raw energy of their own that New York found refreshing. Among the city's musical organizers, it was Red Nichols who took a particular fancy to Gene's style.
Gene had his own thing, and when he came to New York in the late 20s and started recording with the Red Nichols gang, he really perked them up considerably.
Professor Dan Morgenstern.
I mean, he had so much drive, and that made everything sound very different from it, the way it had with Vic Burton and Stan King and guys like that. He really brought a kind of, you know, very strongly African-American-influenced beat into white jazz.
Listen how he builds the drama through a two-chorus piano solo by Joe Sullivan on China Boy in 1930. Red Nichols and His Five Pennies, with Krupa's future leader Benny Goodman on clarinet and trombonist Jack Teagarden. Like Teagarden, Gene Krupa from the start was completely colorblind in the social sense. If there was an interracial recording session in progress, and of course they weren't widely advertised as such, Gene was liable to be there.
The one I always think of is Hello Lola with Red McKenzie. And the lick he plays behind Glenn Miller is just, it's already a swing era lick because the drummer is helping everybody out and moving you toward the out chorus. Terrific, you know.
The whole session was remarkable. With Coleman Hawkins on tenor sax and Pee Wee Russell on clarinet as the major soloists, in Hawkins, maybe for the first time, Gene Krupa met someone playing with the same kind of intensity that he himself favored. That was 80 years ago, 1929, and you get some sense of a guy really spanking the drums till they rang with that metallic sound. Actually, it's rim shots. Gene came to New York in time to share the last sessions of the cornetist Bix Beiderbecke, made before his death from alcoholism in 1931. On a Hoagy Carmichael date, for no known reason, they recorded a rude novelty song called Barnacle Bill the Sailor, which involved Gene in making sudden switches from 6/8 time to his new driving 4/4 style and back again. Bix is pushed hard, but seems to enjoy it.
Who's that knocking at my door? Who's that knocking at my door? Who's that knocking at my door? Cried the fair young maiden.
It's only me from over the sea.
That's Barnacle Bill the Sailor.
I'm all lit up like a Christmas tree.
That's Barnacle Bill the Sailor.
I'll sail the seas until I croak. I'll fight and swear and drink and smoke, but I can't swim a bloody stroke.
That's Barnacle Bill the Sailor.
You know, Gene Krupa was a very modern drummer for 1929, 1930, 31, 32, 33.
Lauren Schoenberg.
And he plays on a lot of record dates with Red Nichols and with Benny Goodman and with others at that time. And people like Stan King, who was a wonderful studio drummer of the era, when you compare their work, Krupa is really speaking an Armstrong and post-Armstrong kind of rhythmic vocabulary. The fills and the rim shots and the cymbal beats, the integration of the various component parts of the drum sets is really radically different from the generation that was slightly before, which is not to put down the wonderful drummers of the 1920s.
Just by being in New York, Gene was learning new stuff. The drummers in New York were showier, bigger in their effects. Sonny Greer with Duke Ellington used to fill the stage with gongs, chimes, timps, and anything he could hit. A guy called George Stafford with Charlie Johnson's Paradise Band in Harlem could apparently play every style, but he died young. But then there was Chick Webb, a tiny, misshapen man afflicted with tuberculosis of the spine. He was a fabulous drummer, famous bandleader, and the mentor of Ella Fitzgerald. But as the jazz critic Gary Giddens confirms, you'll search in vain for any film of him performing.
There's a few seconds in a Vitaphone short. I mean, you can barely see him. It's amazing because they shot the band, But I guess they thought audiences weren't ready for the way Chick looked, so they deliberately tried to keep him out of the shot.
If you listen to Chick Webb's recorded output up to around about 35, 36, it's very dull stuff drum-wise. There's nothing going on. It's one track after another with brushes just playing, you know, four beats. There's nothing there to indicate that this is one of the greatest drummers that was ever in jazz. And it's only really like in the last 2 years of Chick Webb's recorded career that suddenly something happens. I don't know what that thing was, but all of a sudden, the flame is lit and it explodes, and suddenly, it's one hell of an exciting band.
And of course, it's a famous thing that when they had the Battle of the Bands, I think in 1937, at the Savoy Ballroom, where I had the pleasure to work, by the way, with Lucky Millinder many times, they said that Gene went over and said to Chick, "I've never been cut by a better man." And that's kind of a quote that's gone down in the history books, because I'm sure Gene was playing his heart out, and Chick always played his heart out too.
Chick Webb's famous Harlem Congo, a number in which he would have soloed far longer if not for the restrictions of the 3 minute 78 RPM record. Gene learned a whole new drum vocabulary from Chick.
I think Chick affirmed him in the style, in the direction he'd already taken, which was much more driving, much more open, much more incisive and present. Chick certainly has that quality. He's one of the ones who brought the drums stage forward before Gene got the publicity for it. You don't have to make him any cut any slack at all, make any allowances for the era. It's so solid and incisive. And I think it encouraged Gene to keep doing what he was doing in that regard. But it's always wonderful to be part of an era when you know somebody, you know, great that you can always admire is around, because it inspires you. And he was inspired by that very much.
But where to use this new knowledge? That was the problem that faced Krupa in New York. The Depression was growing in strength and the musical opportunities shrinking. Gene's alliance with Red Nichols did bring two useful regular jobs. In Broadway, pit bands for two Gershwin musicals, Strike Up the Band and Girl Crazy.
The great story is how much he impressed Gershwin. George Gershwin, after he showed him how to do a kind of a silent break, Gershwin apparently wanted him in the pit bands for his subsequent shows.
The silent break was a novelty effect where the action and the music suddenly froze into a tableau for a couple of bars during the famous song I've Got a Crush on You. It was Krupa's suggestion. He'd seen it done in a Duke Ellington cabaret sequence at the Cotton Club, and it worked so well that Gershwin did invite him back for his next musical, Girl Crazy. But oddly enough, these experiences only helped to convince Gene that his technique and music theory were full of holes, so he went about some serious study.
He was a very intense student of percussion. He studied all the way up until his death, and I know for a fact that he studied with the great Sanford Moeller, who was a wonderful snare drum teacher. He studied with Jim Chapin, who wrote the fabulous book on independence, and in his later years, he even studied with Saul Goodman up at Juilliard on timpani. He was an eternal student of drumming, and he used to, like I have done myself, he used to collect a lot of African records and Indian records. So he was a very, very keen student.
Ed Shaughnessy. But we leave Gene for this time, still struggling in the early 30s when only the most commercial band work was available. He worked for decent outfits like Irving Aronson's Commanders and very silly ones, like the band movie star Buddy Rogers bought to feature himself playing all the instruments equally badly. The one pointer to the future was an orchestra formed to support the crooner Russ Colombo. Benny Goodman put that band together, and he was the leader. But these are things to come next time. I'm Stuart Copeland, and this has been part one of Gene Krupa, Drumming Man, a Ping production for Radio 2, written by Russell Davies and produced by Graham Pass.